Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay. In order to understand the way to peace, we must first understand the causes of war. In modern times, despite an ever more sophisticated polish to our rhetoric, it is a well-known secret that economic factors normally explain military conflict, especially when industrially developed nations are involved. The Bush war plan against Iraq is no exception. I was initially asked to speak on only the purely economic factors underlying Bush's war plan, but after giving the matter some thought, I soon realized it would be impossible to clearly articulate the economic angle without some reference to the political dynamics. Power and money are interconvertible, and we'll see in the course of this analysis that they are also inextricably bound together. I think it's fairly safe to assume that most people in this room are fully aware of the hollowness of Bush's war rationale. But for the record, I think we should begin with what this war is not about. It is not about weapons of mass destruction. Scott Ritter and others have assured us for years that Iraq is essentially disarmed, and if any further proof were needed, this week's scoop in Newsweek by John Berry, a reporter who's covered Iraqi weapons inspection for more than a decade, that during former defector General Hussein Kamel's 1995 debriefing by officials from the International Atomic Energy Agency and UN inspections team known as UNSCOM, inspectors were told, quote, that after the Gulf War, Iraq destroyed all its chemical and biological weapon stocks and the missiles to deliver them, unquote. Ironically, Bush and his regime have been citing Kamel's interview as proof that Iraq has not disarmed. A son-in-law of Saddam Hussein, Kamel left Iraq in 1995 carrying crates of secret documents on Iraq's past weapons programs. In light of all this, the Bush boys have backed themselves up with the rationale that this war is really about regime change in Baghdad, and we just heard that again last week. But that's not true either. Let me read a bit from a recent article from the London Observer. In 1992, just before Bush's father was defeated by Bill Clinton, Wolfowitz wrote a blueprint to set the nation's direction for the next century, unquote, which is now the foreign policy of George W. Bush. It was entitled Defense Planning Guidance. It put an onus on the Pentagon to establish and to protect a new order under unchallenged American authority. The United States, it said, must be sure of deterring potential competitors from even aspiring to a larger regional or global role, including Germany and Japan. It contemplated the use of nuclear, biological, and chemical weaponry preemptively, even in conflicts that do not directly engage U.S. interests. Wolfowitz's group formalized itself into a group called Project for the New American Century, which included Cheney and another old friend, former Pentagon Undersecretary for Policy under Reagan, Richard Perle. In a document 2 years ago, the project pondered that what was needed was to assure U.S. global power was, quote, some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And remember, this was written before 9/11. The document had noted that while the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides immediate justification for intervention, and now listen to this carefully, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein. End quote. Okay, then. The war drive is not motivated by concern about weapons of mass destruction or by a problem with Saddam Hussein. What, then, does impel this war? The most obvious answer is oil. The peace movement slogan rightly remains, no blood for oil. But does this refer to the desire of the big oil companies to recover the direct control of Iraqi oil lost to them when it was nationalized by Iraq 30 years ago? Does it mean that the United States, with only 2% of the world's oil reserves, would like to direct the disposition of Iraq's 20-plus percent of this strategic resource? Does it mean that Dick Cheney's Halliburton Corporation is chomping at the bit for a piece of the action in developing Iraq's oil fields? And with our economy hitting the skids, is it just possible that George W. Bush would like to shore up the political support that always accrues to our commander-in-chief during wartime? The last question shows once again how the political and economic are of one piece. Let's consider the relationship of oil to this war at length. In an article published in Open Democracy last December entitled The Oil Reckoning, Paul Rogers writes, quote, to get an idea of the importance of Iraqi oil in the coming decades, look at it this way. Take the total known oil reserves for the Caspian Basin outside of Iran. Then add the oil reserves of Siberia. Add to these the remaining North Sea oil reserves, and then include the West Shetland fields. finally put in the entire oil reserves in the United States, including Alaska fields that have yet to be developed. If we put all these together, we get fairly close to 10% of all oil reserves in the world. Iraq alone has more than this, and adding the other Gulf states, we get close to 70% of world reserves. In fact, Iraq is known to have some 20% of world reserves, and recent speculation indicates that it may have even more than that, since much of its potential remains unexplored, and that it may even possess more than Saudi Arabia, which is known to possess 25% of the world's proven reserves. Oil, of course, is the lifeblood of modern war. Without it, fighters and bombers can't fly, ships can't transport materiel, and mobile howitzers are immobilized. To say that oil is a strategic resource is almost an understatement. It can be argued that Hitler lost the Second World War because he literally ran out of gas. Near the war's end, Panzer tanks had been abandoned all over Eastern Front because petrol supplies had diminished to such an extent that there was nothing else to do with them. Then, of course, there is the consumer and industrial economy. In her article for the Toronto Star entitled, "The Thing Is, It Is About Oil," Linda McQuaig writes, "One of the striking things about Iraq's oil reserves, besides their sheer volume, is how undeveloped they are. This isn't just because of the past decade of sanctions. It goes back to the 1920s when the seven major oil companies, American and British, began operating in the Middle East. The companies functioned as a cartel. With explicit agreements not to compete against each other, they carved up the rich Middle East oil reserves, thereby enabling them to control most of the world's oil supply and keep prices and profits high. All this was documented by a U.S. Senate investigation in the 1950s. The fledgling Arab states, created out of the old Ottoman Empire, had little choice but to accept the piddling royalties the companies offered. Iraq was always more demanding than the others. In the early 1960s, the popular Iraqi leader, Abdul Karim Qasim, invited in some independent oil companies as competition for the cartel. The cartel didn't like this, and since it controlled access to world oil markets, the independents stayed away from Iraq. The cartel punished Iraq by pumping less Iraqi oil, thereby reducing the nation's meager revenues. Instead of knuckling under to the cartel, Iraq tried something bolder in 1972. It nationalized its oil. Neighboring Iran had attempted a similar nationalization in the 50s, but the U.S. and Britain stepped in and organized a coup that replaced the nationalistic leader there. The West couldn't really intervene to stop the Iraqi nationalization, however, because Iraq invited in the Soviets to develop its oil fields and buy its oil. The Iraqi deal with the Soviets, regarded as the ultimate treachery by the oil companies, Washington and London, was negotiated by the number two man in the new Ba'athist regime that had seized power in Iraq. His name was Saddam Hussein. The companies and Western powers were further incensed the following year with the emergence of OPEC as an aggressive cartel of oil-producing nations determined to win a bigger share of the oil wealth, with Iraq the leading militant. Now in the post-Soviet era, Iraq's oil fields remain huge, undeveloped, ripe for exploitation, and essentially unprotected. And the treacherous Saddam remains in power. Now that Iraq's formidable Soviet patron is history, do the Seven Sisters, as they are called, want their oil back? You bet your bippy they do. Of course, also in for a bonanza are the oil field services companies. In a recent Reuters article, Irwin Saber writes, U.S. oil field service companies stand to strike it big in any post-war reconstruction of an Iraqi oil industry suffering from rundown equipment and years of anemic investment. But are they ready? So far, Halliburton, Schlumberger Limited, and privately held Bechtel Group Incorporated have remained tight-lipped over any possible plans for Iraq, which currently produces a little more than 2 million barrels of oil per day. Iraq has oil reserves of 112 billion barrels, second behind Saudi Arabia, and can ultimately raise oil production to 6 million barrels per day. To protect the reserves from sabotage by Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, the Pentagon has said U.S. troops would secure Iraq's biggest oil fields. And experts say the $5 billion of investment needed to restore production to where it was before the 1991 Gulf War could pay big dividends for oil service companies. Quote, "There's a lot of opportunity for oil service companies depending on the outcome of the conflict," unquote, said Robin Shoemaker, an industry analyst for Bear Stearns. There's been a low level of investment in Iraq for the last 10 to 12 years. International oil service companies' technology is expected to be at the forefront of rebuilding Iraq's oil industry, which has been starved of investment because of UN trade embargo. We can almost hear the CEOs of the big oil companies and the oil field services industry singing happy days are here again. But what about the larger question of oil consumption and supply for the U.S. economy? Neil McKay reports in the Edinburgh Sunday Herald that 5 months before September 11th, the U.S. advocated using force against Iraq to secure control of its oil. He analyzes a document that fundamentally questions the motives behind the Bush administration's desire to take out Saddam Hussein and to go to war with Iraq. Quote, it's called Strategic Energy Policy Challenges for the 21st Century, and it describes how America is facing the biggest energy crisis in our history. It targets Saddam as a threat to American interests because of his control of Iraqi oil fields and recommends the use of, quote, military intervention, unquote, as a means to fix the U.S. energy crisis. And I just want to interject there that you may recall the energy policy conference that was secreted in the earlier part of the Bush administration that we still don't know who attended, we still don't know what they talked about, and they still refuse to account to the Government Accounting Office for any of this, although the suit was just dropped a couple of weeks ago by the GAO. So that's, I think this is referring back to that same conference. The report is linked to a veritable who's who of U.S. hawks, oilmen, and corporate bigwigs. It was commissioned by James Baker, the former U.S. Secretary of State under George Bush Sr., and submitted to Vice President Dick Cheney a full 5 months before September 11th. Yet it advocates a policy of using military force against an enemy such as Iraq to secure U.S. access to and control of Middle Eastern oil fields. One of the most telling passages in the document reads, quote, Iraq remains a destabilizing influence to the flow of oil to the international markets from the Middle East. Saddam Hussein has also demonstrated a willingness to threaten to use the oil weapon and to use his own export program to manipulate oil markets. This would display his personal power, enhance his image as a pan-Arab leader, and pressure others for lifting of the economic sanctions against his regime. The United States should conduct an immediate policy review toward Iraq, including military, energy, economic, and political diplomatic assessments. The United States should then develop an integrated strategy with key allies in Europe and Asia, and with key countries in the Middle East to restate goals with respect to Iraqi policy and to restore a cohesive coalition of key allies, unquote. At the moment, UN sanctions allow Iraq to export some oil. Indeed, the U.S. imports almost 1 million barrels of Iraqi oil a day, even though American firms are forbidden from direct involvement with the regime's oil industry. In 1999, Iraq was exporting around 2.5 million barrels a day across the world. The U.S. document recommends using U.N. weapons inspectors as a means of controlling Iraqi oil. Remember, this is 2 years before the present. On the one hand, quote, military intervention, unquote, is supported, but the report also backs, quote, defanging, quote, Saddam through weapons inspectors and then moving in to take control of Iraqi oil. Now, that's kind of spooky when you think about this was written 2 years ago. And it's what we're looking at right now. Once an arms control program is in place, the U.S. could consider reducing restrictions on oil investment inside Iraq, it reads. The reason for this is that Iraqi oil reserves represent a major asset that can quickly add capacity to world oil markets and inject a more competitive tenor to oil trade. The document also points out that the United States remains a prisoner of its energy dilemma and that one of the consequences of this is a need for military intervention. Thus far, we've reviewed the more classic explanations of what we mean by blood for oil, but there is one more thesis that must be considered before we move on to consider the political dynamic of this war. This might usefully reframe our slogan to no blood for petrodollars. The monetary explanation is provided by W. Clark in the Australian Guardian. In substance, the argument runs as follows. The United States dollar has declined 17% against the euro in the last 2 years. One thing that upholds the value of the U.S. dollar is its easy exchangeability for valuable resources, especially oil, which in that case is dubbed a petrodollar. Quoting from Mr. Clark's article, quote, Saddam sealed his fate when he decided to switch to the euro in late 2000 and later converted his $10 billion reserve fund in the UN to euros. At that point, another manufactured Gulf War became inevitable under George Bush II. The steady depreciation of the dollar versus the euro since late 2001 means that Iraq has profited handsomely from the switch in their reserve and transaction currencies. The euro has gained roughly 17% against the dollar in that time, which also applies to the $10 billion in Iraq's UN Oil for Food Reserve Fund that was previously held in dollars but also gained that same percent value since the switch. If you think this has something to do with Iraq being construed as part of the axis of evil, let me add some more grist to your mill. During 2002, Iran shifted the majority of its reserve funds in its central bank to euros. And last but not least, North Korea, 3 months ago, decided to drop the dollar and officially use the euro for trade. In case you've forgotten, those are the three countries that George Bush named as the axis of evil. Why is this such a major concern? Quote, I hypothesize that President Bush intends to topple Saddam in 2003 in a preemptive attempt to initiate massive Iraqi oil production in far excess of OPEC quotas to reduce global oil prices and thereby dismantle OPEC's price controls. The end goal of the neoconservatives is incredibly bold yet simple in purpose, to use the, quote, war on terror, unquote, as a premise to finally dissolve OPEC's decision-making process, thus ultimately preventing the cartel's inevitable switch to pricing oil in euros. The Iraq war is not a moneymaker, but it could be an OPEC breaker. That, however, is a long-term outcome that will require Iraq to be successfully reconstituted into a functioning state in which massive oil sector investment can take place. What would happen if OPEC made a sudden switch to euros as opposed to a gradual transition? Otherwise, the effect of an OPEC switch to the euro would be that oil-consuming nations would have to flush dollars out of their central bank reserve funds and replace these with euros. The dollar would crash anywhere from 20% to 40% in value, and the consequences would be those one could expect from any currency collapse and massive inflation. Think Argentina currency crisis, for example. You'd have foreign funds stream out of the U.S. stock market and dollar-denominated assets. There'd be a run on the banks, much like the 1930s. The current account deficit would become unserviceable. The budget deficit would go into default, and so on. Your basic third world economic crisis scenario. In the aftermath of toppling Saddam, it is clear the U.S. will keep a large and permanent military force in the Persian Gulf. Indeed, there is no exit strategy in Iraq, as the military will be needed to protect the newly installed Iraqi regime and perhaps send a message to other OPEC producers that they might receive regime change too if they also move to euros for their oil exports. Clark concludes, it would appear that any attempt by OPEC member states in the Middle East or Latin America to transition to the euro as their oil transaction currency standard shall be met with either overt U.S. military actions or covert U.S. intelligence agency interventions. Under the guise of the perpetual war on terror, quote unquote, the Bush administration is manipulating the American people about the unspoken but very real macroeconomic reasons for this upcoming war with Iraq. This war in Iraq will have nothing to do with any threat from Saddam's old weapons of mass destruction program. This war will be over the global currency of oil. Moving into the confluence of the economic and the political, we must consider the military-industrial complex itself. It goes without saying that war is good for war business, so obviously there is no need to belabor that point. And while there has been more than the usual criticism of the Bush war plan from within the military than is usual for American military adventures, the actual bellicose foreign policy was drawn up initially by militarists like Cheney, Powell, and Wolfowitz. Its first incarnation in 1992 was called Defense Planning Guidance. According to a report by David Armstrong in Harper's Magazine, it included the new theme of prioritizing prevention of the emergence of regional rivals everywhere to U.S. hegemony. We could then, as Colin Powell told the Armed Services Committee, deter any challenger from ever dreaming of challenging us on the world stage, unquote. To emphasize his point, he cast the United States in the role of a street thug, quote, from Powell again, I want to be the bully on the block, unquote, he said. Well, who says our government never tells the truth? But moving directly into the political sphere, we have the elephant in the living room that no one ever wants to talk about. We have Zionist Israel and its impact on U.S. foreign policy. which has both a political and an economic dimension. We haven't time for an extensive discussion of this crucial question. It's really a fit subject for a whole First Friday forum all to itself. According to a recent New York Times article, in the tatters of Oslo, Israel is putting all its chips in the basket of a war with Iraq, after which it hopes the U.S. will continue on to Iran and then Syria, which it regards as even greater threats. I think one U.S. military expert was quoted as saying, real men want to go to Tehran, as opposed to Baghdad. The Times article also points out that, quote, Israelis have also suggested that the war might salvage their economy and prompt recalcitrant labor to join Mr. Sharon's coalition in a new government of national unity, unquote, in addition to teaching other regional threats a lesson. But the Israeli influence comes much closer to home. In addition to the powerful AIPAC lobby, which has some 130 employees and 8 full-time professional lobbyists, there is Israel's fifth column right in our own government. The following words were written by award-winning British journalist Robert Fisk. Quote, the men driving Bush to war are mostly former or still active pro-Israeli lobbyists. For years they have advocated destroying the most powerful Arab nation. Richard Perle, one of Bush's most influential advisors, Douglas Faith, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, and Donald Rumsfeld were all campaigning for the overthrow of Iraq long before George W. Bush was elected, if he was elected, U.S. president. And they weren't doing so for the benefit of Americans or Britons. A 1996 report, quote, it was called A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, unquote, called for a war on Iraq. It was written not for the U.S., but for the incoming Israeli Likud Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and produced by a group headed by, yes, Richard Perle. The destruction of Iraq will, of course, protect Israel's monopoly of nuclear weapons and allow it to defeat the Palestinians and oppose whatever colonial settlement Sharon has in store. Although Bush and Blair dare not discuss this with us, as a war with Israel is not going to have our boys lining up for the recruiting offices, Jewish American leaders talk about the advantages of an Iraqi war with enthusiasm. Indeed, those very courageous Jewish American groups who so bravely oppose this madness have been the first to point out how pro-Israeli organizations foresee Iraq not only as a new source of oil, but of water too. Why should canals not link the Tigris River to the parched Levant? No wonder, then, that any discussion on this topic must be censored, as Professor Elliot Cohen of Johns Hopkins University tried to do in the Wall Street Journal the day after Powell's UN speech. Cohen suggested that European nations' objections to the war might, yet again, be ascribed to, quote, anti-Semitism of a type long thought dead in the West, a loathing that ascribes to Jews a malignant intent, unquote. This nonsense, it must be said, is opposed by many Israeli intellectuals who, like Yuri Avnery, argue that an Iraq war will leave Israel with even more Arab enemies, especially if Iraq attacks Israel and Sharon then joins the U.S. battle against the Arabs. In conclusion, let me suggest that any American who takes the time to seriously study all of these matters is bound to draw the same conclusions. Bush's war against Iraq has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction, a planned pretext, nor even with regime change in the narrow sense of that term. Today's peace movement is up against extremely powerful entrenched forces, the still predominant monetary system in the world today, big oil and related industries, the third most militarily powerful nation in the world today, along with its plethora of fifth columnists in our country, including the second most powerful lobbying group in America, and the panoply of Zionist State Department and Defense Department officials. To these we can add a suborned mainstream media, which, though not completely in the war camp as of yet, treats us like the Houston Chronicle to an endless parade of hawkish hacks such as Krauthammer, Friedman, Sapphire, and Hoagland in order to, as Herman and Chomsky put it, manufacture our consent. And then there's the military complex itself, whose only slogan is that war is good for business. But unhappily, we are living in an age where few citizens take or feel they have the time necessary to devote to such questions. We are indeed living in the age of sound bites. So I suggest in conclusion that we modify our own just a bit in order to include in its sweep a bit more of the complexity of the forces propelling Bush's aggression against Iraq. No blood for oil, the dollar, or Israel. Thank you.
This is something you might be able to answer for me, since you've obviously done a lot of research. I know that before Iraq invaded Kuwait, they checked with our ambassador to see what the United States' response would be, and our ambassador's response was that would be that, as far as we were concerned, that would be a matter between Iraq and Kuwait, that we had no interest in that. Now, that's either indicative of a high degree of stupidity or a high degree of chicanery. And I know that the thing that the Iraqi justification that precipitated that invasion of Kuwait was that the Kuwaitis had increased their oil production at a time when Iraq was desperate for oil currency. My question is, my suspicion is that we were encouraging that for the specific reason of justifying a permanent military presence in that region, hoping that Saudi Arabia would allow us to stay in there. But then, since after the war was over, Saudi Arabia booted us out. Now this is phase two. But my question is, do you have any knowledge of us encouraging the Kuwaitis to increase their production at that specific time when the Iraqis were desperate for oil revenue?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, there's a pretty well-developed theory that the whole Gulf War was a setup. And the woman that you were talking about there, the ambassador's name was April Glaspie. And she did have this conference with Saddam Hussein where many people say essentially gave him the green light to go ahead. And it's important to recall when we think about this that previous to that, the United States did give the green light to Saddam Hussein to fight a war against Iraq, to launch a war against Iran. So this would be in keeping with the practice of the United States. And he thought he was being given every encouragement. And remember, the United States used to give him intelligence and everything else to help him fight that war against Iran, although United States played on both sides of that particular war. Going back to your question about Kuwait, not only did they encourage Kuwait to increase their oil production at a time when this caused oil prices to decline, when Iraq needed that foreign exchange badly to start paying off its war debts, Kuwait also insisted on immediate repayment of war debts based on the money that they had fronted Iraq to fight their war against Iran also, because they were also threatened by the fundamentalist Islam of Iran. I mean, their own regime was not secure with respect to Islam either. And there was a third issue too. There was slant drilling going on underneath the borders of Iraq from Kuwait. They were slant drilling right into Iraq and sucking out from a major oil field oil that really properly belonged to Iraq. So there were many provocations, and some people believe that those provocations were deliberate, and that once Iraq got into that war, of course, then the trap was shut down on them, and that's when the United States and Britain foreclosed. Now, there's a book called The Arming of Iraq, which I encourage you to read if you're really interested in the subject. But what this author basically claims is that war was the most expensive product recall in history, because basically what it was about was causing Iraq to have to use its arms and to then be disarmed from the very arms that were sold to it by the United States and by Britain and the other advanced countries. So there's no question that disarmament is what was desired out of that war. The point is that's the whole thing may have been a ploy in order to bring that about, and a weakening of Iraq as a regional power, which of course pleases Israel.